may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jean McKean. I'm here on behalf of the defendant in this matter, the appellant, Mr. Daryl Hawkins. Your Honor, honors have had the chance of reading the brief, so I'll try not to belabor them. Our basic position is that the trial court erred in failing to grant a mistrial of the June 2015 two-day jury trial. The trial court had erred as a result of the egregious questioning of the Commonwealth, and it's our position that that questioning was designed to and did elicit irrelevant and overly prejudicial information that resulted in the appellant not being able to receive a fair trial in front of the jury. As Your Honors have seen in our brief, we've emphasized that even the trial court judge recognized that the bell had been rung, and she couldn't unrung the bell, and she further, at a motion for mistrial, acknowledged that she didn't know if she had created a further problem. Unfortunately, Your Honor, we would ask the courts to take a look at the totality of this record. We've argued in our brief that not only should the mistrial have been granted, but it should be barred from retrial as the history. And I apologize for the large appendix, but I think the history was important, showing the elements to bar the mistrial.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
The Commonwealth's position in reference to whether it should be barred is that under 5820, that it wasn't preserved because it wasn't ruled on by the trial court.
Your Honor, absolutely, Your Honor. I think counsel had indicated that we had waived our objection, that we had actually acquiesced to it, because there was one phrase where the judge had indicated what she thought was the only thing she could do, and he equivocally said, when she asked, he said that's the only thing that he could think of. In this case, we would assert that the record is abundant with the objections throughout in numerous places. I don't know how he could have objected anymore. He objected initially when the Commonwealth was questioning. He objected again the second day of trial. And we would assert that the trial court never indicated that he had waived his objection. When he had objected...
Did counsel ask for a curative instruction as an alternative matter to deal with it?
Your Honors, I think the soliloquy indicates that the trial court judge and the counsel, all three of them in conference, tried to discuss what curative efforts that could be done.
And the agreement was judge suggested that...
Well, and I don't think it was an agreement, and I think that's what counsel respectfully is arguing, but when you look at the actual trial transcript, it clearly indicates during the transcript, I believe, if I can find the pages, Your Honor, when the judge suggested the curative, the defense counsel objected, the judge recognized that, I think her terms exactly were, the bell's been rung, I can't unring it, what do we do? And the judge said, the only thing I know that we can do now is to read all of these heinous charges into the record and to read that he was not found guilty.
But counsel, what did we do with the fact that the attorney for the appellant indicated that he was okay with that directive? In fact, I think it's almost a quote of what he said. Isn't that an acquiescence or, in fact, an agreement? Because he also sort of indicated that at first he didn't want her to read in the charges, but then conceded that was probably the only proper way to handle it.
Your Honor, with all due respect, at most it was equivocal, and he didn't agree. He said, I think that's the only thing that we can do. And he didn't even get a chance to finish, and the trial court specifically said, I will reserve your motion for mistrial, indicating to counsel that it was still preserved. He did not acquiesce. He did not say, I find that is an acceptable curative action. He said, I think that's the only thing we can do, but he didn't say, I find that satisfactory. And in the transcript, you will say, and I was not there, but he states that, and then she immediately says, I will reserve the motion. I'll take the motion for mistrial under advisement. So
did she rule on that?
She did not rule. She took it underneath advisement. They went to the next day of jury trial, And then defense counsel again said, I will renew my objection. And at that point in time, she said, I know that you want to the effect, I know that you would like to circumvent all the extra trial, but I will reserve my judgment on that and I will make a ruling at a later time. There was a hearing. They made a ruling at that hearing. And then again, he objected at that point in time. So he has repeatedly objected again and again and again. And again, the court kept on saying, Mr. Beal, I'm taking it under advisement. I hear your objection, and I am taking it under advisement with the rest of the issues, but I hear it, and it's noted for the record. And that was on the second day of trial. So he objected the first time when it was made. She said, I don't know what else to do, the curative action. He said, I apologize. She said, this is what we're going to do. He says, I think that's the only thing we can do. And then she said, but I'm reserving only for keeping it under the motion under advisement. And then again, he turns around the second day of jury trial. He objects again. So I would assert in the facts of this case, and it's all in my reply brief, Your Honor, he clearly has not waived his objection in this matter. And a reading doing so would be egregiously unfair, and it would be disruptive to the quorum. You would have to, I don't know how many more times he could have made his objections.
Counsel, let's assume that we agree with the Commonwealth that he waived it at that point in time. Can you talk to us a little bit about the closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, and that's why I put in the history of this case. Unfortunately, in this case, the trial court judge was trying to manage a fair trial, and he had given pretty distinct instructions along the way. Unfortunately, even after saying repeatedly, look, I find this prejudicial, I can't unring the bell, this is the only thing we can do, in closing argument, we have a man charged with dogfighting. And in closing argument, again, the Commonwealth says, look, and he reads those. I mean, heinously, he doesn't say, just let him get off. He says, and he tells you to find the defendant not guilty, just like he was found not guilty for assaulting his wife and then destroying her property.
Counsel, is there any perspective that that would be the Commonwealth commenting on evidence that was in record? Or the exhibit came in with a listing of all of the offenses and the dates, and that was not objected to by the appellant. So would that be, in essence, fair game for him to comment on evidence that is before the jury?
Respectfully, I would assert that it was objected to, but assuming your argument...
it's not an argument. My question is is it improper for him to comment on evidence that's already before the jury?
I think in this case it absolutely is, given the trial court's repeated admonishments that it was prejudicial, that he's had these charges that he was not found guilty of, and that he's had these protective orders, and she's admonished him repeatedly, and then again he brings them out in closing argument. Our position is there's no waiver, but that is overly prejudicial given the repeated admonishments and the fact that it's irrelevant, that it is irrelevant to dogfighting. It's not contemporaneous. These were from 2002 to 2010, and we have assaultive behaviors, charges, and the current charges before the court were dogfighting charges, and they're overly prejudicial. And his statements are overly prejudicial. They say, look, this man's a heinous man. He's gotten off scot-free on all these charges. Of course that's prejudicial to whether he's guilt or his guilty or innocence of dogfighting based on the evidence. It is clearly prejudicial both to finding of guilt or innocence on the dogfighting and additionally to sentencing, Your Honor. In this case, there was no evidence of any injured dogs. All the veterinarians said that they were healthy. The jury gave him 4 out of 5 years of active incarceration for one dogfighting, promoting dogfighting conviction. We would assert that the inference clearly is that it's prejudicial. They were out to get this gentleman because he's a bad guy with assaultive behaviors that he was found not guilty of, and the Commonwealth put that in.
The trial court also found that the jury could have found that it was evidence of the wife's lack of truthfulness.
Again, if you look, she first of all, when he asked her those questions, she said, that's not true. So she has disputed that she is not, that she is fearful of her husband. Number two, it was not relevant in time. Clearly, it's contemporaneous. That was 2002 to 2010, and even the trial court judge acknowledged, look, it's irrelevant. The trial court judge acknowledged because obviously they've been living as in wedded bliss for the last 5 years.
I meant in terms of the court's determination as to why the mistrial motion would not be granted. The trial court basically indicated that the jury could take that testimony as indication that maybe they just didn't believe her and not for the purpose of indicating that he was more likely or had a propensity of committing another offense.
You know, I think in the record it states it was, and I'll withdraw that, Your Honor. I don't have an answer for, I would maintain that it is irrelevant. It's not for truthfulness. He never asserted it for truthfulness. The record shows that he was, the argument for the Commonwealth was to show that she was in fear of her husband, not for truthfulness. And he never made that argument. So he would have waived that argument, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth would assert that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion for a mistrial, that the second assignment of error should be dismissed, and that the evidence was sufficient to find the defendant guilty of breeding dogs for the purpose of dogfighting. First, the trial court correctly found that the defendant had not sufficiently demonstrated prejudice to warrant a new trial based on the prosecutor's original questioning of the defendant's wife. As the court has already discussed with the defendant agreed to the curative, which ended up...
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Would that actually be described as a curative instruction? Given the fact there's no directive to do anything, but simply something put before the jury without direction as to what they want to do.
Certainly, Your Honor, I think that the curative in this case that was chosen by the trial court and the defense attorney was an interesting strategy and, in their minds, was the best thing to do in order to... I think their concern was that it had been 5 years ago and they wanted to make sure that the jury knew that these charges were from a previous date in order for the defense to argue that now they had a good marriage.
Did the judge just compound the problem?
I think
the curative instruction would have been disregard.
I think that a instruction to disregard could have been appropriate in this situation if someone had suggested it. Unfortunately, no one suggested it in the record. And what ultimately happened and what we have on the record is that the defendant agreed the best thing to do was read the charges in. And the trial court asks all of them, yes. There's no acquiescence. It's an affirmative, yes, this is what you should do.
So is your position that it's a general waiver because of the agreement as opposed to the case law that indicates in terms of the curative measures and whether the appellant agrees or doesn't object?
My argument is that because the defendant agreed to that specific curative, the defendant...
I'm asking a different
question. I'm trying to get there.
What I'm asking you is if we indicate this is not a curative instruction, right, what does it do to your waiver argument?
Well, the fact that the defendant can't approbate and reprobate, essentially, because the defendant asked and agreed to what happened and is now saying, well, no, those charges should never have been read into the record. Those charges are so prejudicial, but they were read into the record because of the agreement. The defendant cannot now argue that that was incorrect because he agreed to it. So even if this court were to find because the trial court essentially kept the motion under advisement, and so therefore the defendant didn't waive the original objection. The original objection was to the prosecutor's statements. The original objection wasn't to reading all these charges into the record. That was the agreement.
Is there any place in the record where the defendant argues that what the trial court did was incorrect?
I think when they come back on the second day, essentially, that might be what the defendant is trying to get at. Like, I slept on this. This is really bothering me. I move for a mistrial again. But
But your position would be that doesn't cure the fact that they originally agreed to it.
At that point, it's too late.
Reprimand.
Exactly. No. Precisely, Your Honor. That was the Commonwealth's position, that a party cannot invite error and then to take advantage of the error that he's asked for,
agree with. It's a little different than inviting it. I mean, in this instance, it was the judge that came up with the cure.
Yes, it was the judge's idea, but then the defendant agreed to it and said that was what was appropriate. Affirmatively, yes, that is what all the charges into the record.
This came well at the time the, quote, curative matters are taken. The court also instructs Mr. Spencer at that point in time to make no further references to the collateral criminal charges, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor. And
so with that in mind, how is what he did in closing argument not a big problem for the Commonwealth?
If you look at the closing arguments, the first time, on page 1360 is when the prosecutor first mentions it. And what he says is that his wife has, he's talking about the wife's testimony, and he assaulted her, but he says, you'll have to look at this when you're trying to decide who's telling the truth. He's talking about it in terms of impeaching the wife and whether or not her testimony was true because she was scared of him. And then...
But he was told not to make any reference to those charges, and that's exactly what he's doing. And regardless of the purpose for which he's doing, he's told not to do it because the only reason those were read in was as a curative matter, and then he tries to use those to his advantage. Why is that not a big problem, especially when he then goes on to essentially say, don't find him not guilty of these the way he was found not guilty of the prior charges. Basically, don't let him get away with this after he got away with the other things.
First, I would say that this part of his closing argument was not objected to, that he was simply, as Judge Malva pointed out, commenting on evidence that was in...
not to comment.
It was perhaps ill-advised, but it was not objected to. And then to turn to the second point of your question, the defendant actually brings up the charges in his closing argument on page 1390, and he's the one who, he says, remember, he's not found guilty of all these charges.
Well, but counsel, isn't that more damage control than anything else?
Certainly, Your Honor.
When the Commonwealth goes awry in his closing, you know, you can't just ignore the elephant in the room if you're the defense attorney, you've got to react somehow.
Certainly, Your Honor, and it would be the Commonwealth's position that then when the Commonwealth attorney comments it on again in his rebuttal closing on 1412, that is what he is responding to specifically.
Well, except for counsel, if you agree with the remarks that the Commonwealth makes, isn't it arguably that he's making a propensity argument?
I think he's saying that the defendant is asking you to find him not guilty, just like he was found not guilty of those other charges, but in this case isn't an innuendo case. This case isn't, I can't get in his head, but what it appears from the record is he is not saying, hold those charges against him. He's saying,
he's taking the position that the wife is lying, that these are charges in which he was getting away or got away with him because she was scared of him. That's the whole reason for bringing it up in terms of the impeachment.
Certainly,
how else are we supposed to read it for purposes of the second part of the closing in terms of anything other than propensity?
I think that the Commonwealth's position would be that it doesn't have to do with propensity for him to commit any crime. The Commonwealth appears to just be arguing that the defendant is asking him to be found not guilty, and I think as the trial court recognized, those charges that he was found not guilty of could have been because either the wife was lying then or lying now, and that is what the Commonwealth's focus actually was in introducing this evidence, and he repeatedly stated that on the record. Whether or not his attempts were well advised, that is, from the record, very clear. He was solely trying to use this evidence to make the wife look like a liar, not to make the defendant look like he had committed all these acts.
And there was an objection to the closing argument, correct?
To that part, yes, Your Honor. The second part, the defense attorney goes to speak up, and the court says, basically, I'm keeping everything under advisement. That's on page 1413. But the Commonwealth would argue the defendant has still failed to demonstrate the trial court abused its discretion in denying the mistrial because the prosecutor's statements only went to the bias of the defendant's wife, the witness. They did not go to an element of the crime. They did not go to the defendant's propensity to commit this particular crime. And the defendant was actually acquitted of all those charges. And the defendant has just failed to show that it permeated the entire trial so to influence the verdict. And as the trial court found on page 1514, the jury could have thought that Mrs. Hawkins was just a liar when she brought those charges. The jury could have thought a number of things. But we just don't know, and therefore the trial court did not abuse its discretion in finding that Hawkins had failed to demonstrate he was so prejudiced that he warranted another trial. Turning to the second assignment of error briefly, I think I covered in brief that the assignment of error should be dismissed because it does not assign any error to anything the trial court did or did not do. If this court were to find that a motion for mistrial should have been granted, the Commonwealth's position would be that the trial court should have the opportunity to decide whether or not the case can be retried. If this court were to determine that it can look at the record, Commonwealth would assert that the prosecutor did not goad the defendant into declaring or into moving for a mistrial. It's very clear from the record that this prosecutor was trying very hard for a conviction and not for a mistrial in order to obtain a conviction at a later date. And finally, turning to the last assignment of error, the evidence was sufficient to find the defendant guilty of promoting a dogfighting activity by breeding. There was two expert witnesses who testified at length, unobjected to, uncontroverted. They testified all the physical evidence seized at the defendant's property was consistent with dogfighting. Neither had ever seen a breeding stand used for anything other than with dogfighting dogs. They testified about the pedigrees that were found at the defendant's house, the advertisement for the defendant's own puppies, which contained dog-fighting language, and two of the four dogs had to be euthanized for aggression. The jury was entitled, as the fact finder, to weigh the credibility and determine that the defendant was not credible, reject his testimony that he was breeding dogs for any legitimate purpose, and find that he was, in fact, breeding dogs for dog-fighting. If the court has no further questions, the Commonwealth would ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Ms. McKean? A few minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't want to belabor the issues, but it again is our position that the defense counsel did not acquiesce to the judge's curative and did not waive any objection. And we would ask the court to look at the cumulative transcript and the numerous amounts of time that he did object. Additionally, the appeal noted, Mr. Hawkins immediately noted on the conclusion of the trial that he intended to appeal and stated that it was because of the untruths by Mr. Spencer, and court-appointed counsel was appointed immediately that day. Clearly, he did not waive his objections to Mr. Spencer's questioning of his wife. I would also ask the court to just look at the cumulative record in this case. It started, the original arrest was way back in 2013. There has been a history. An initial mistrial was granted for the Commonwealth's failure to provide exculpatory evidence. Understandably, the second trial, a two-day jury trial, unfortunately the judge, I'm sure, was in a hard situation, and she recognized the prejudicial error in those statements, and she acknowledged that the bell had been rung and that she was unsure whether she could correct it.
Counsel, what about the Attorney General's argument that only some of the closing arguments were objected to?
Your Honor, again, if you look at the total, I think every time that the defense counsel stood up to object, clearly it was clear what he was objecting to, and you look at the record and the judge would note that I'm keeping it underneath advisement. I'm keeping it underneath advisement. It was clear that he was bringing back up the solicited testimony by Ms. Hawkins and trying to bring in all those prejudicial charges, and Mr. Spencer's bringing that again into closing. I think it's clear from the record that he did fully object to that again. Again, this case is just full of objections, and I would ask the court to recognize that, and anything else would be a travesty to justice and would prevent a defendant from obtaining a fair trial and would encourage commonwealths to continue such egregious behavior, particularly in the direct, repeated admonishment by the trial court judge. And I will tell you, there was a motion in limine.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you. Just as a quick point, one of the things I'd asked earlier that I don't know if I've heard about was in reference to the 5820 argument that the Commonwealth made in terms of whether the Commonwealth was goading this matter into a mistrial. Where is that actually appropriately set out as an error? I think that's one of the things that the Commonwealth has indicated.
I think in the motion for mistrial, the defense counsel repeatedly referred to all the previous bad acts and the previous mistrial. He referred to the prior mistrial for.
But the court did not rule on that, so I think their point was that it's not something that we can take up.
On the
rather. On whether the Commonwealth attorney tried to basically force this matter into a mistrial through his own misdeeds.
I think it directly at the end of the September 21st hearing, basically he had filed that motion, and basically she said, "I deny your motion." And in that motion, there was a written motion and an oral motion made on September 21st, so I would assert that she did rule on it. That was in the written motion, and so when she said she denied your motion, it was proffered before the court, so I would assert respectfully that the evidence is sufficient that she did rule on that motion. And I would ask the court, I think I have 38 seconds, if there's a final question.
No, it's you're out of your time.
I apologize.
That's okay, though, because I want to make sure Judge Malvo's question was answered. And Judge Allen. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We're going to come down and brief counsel.
Nice to see you.
Counsel, we're going to take a quick break before the next case so you all can set up for the next case, and we'll be back momentarily.
Any counsel has since come in. If you're arguing today, the signing sheets will be over here.
Thank you. It was there, and this never happened.
My God.
Because it wasn't.